Last week, we worked on the actual precepts, and I pointed out how they are the turning point when they are correctly understood, completely the turning point for turning the stream of compassion within. And that it is not before one gets over the irritation and the anger that one begins to have compassion for oneself. The irritation and the anger, that is, with what people have done with you, what you have been forced to do, how you have been brought up, all the little things that make you into the person that you would rather not be. That being so, remember that the third Kensho, the signs of the actual personality changes in the third Kensho, are the complete lack of even the slightest sensual desire, lustful desire, and the lack of anger and irritation. Now, you can roughly speaking divide up the 10 precepts into two halves, those that pertain more to lust, or are caused primarily by lust, and those that pertain more to irritation and anger, or are caused more by irritation and anger. All 10 of them can be caused by either, but some tend to do it much more than others. If you look at the 10, you'll find that killing, stealing, coveting, not saying that which is true, and selling the wine of delusion come very much under lust. Think about it, and you'll see what I'm talking about by saying this. They come very much more under the lustful side of it than under the anger. Look at the other half. Speaking against others, being proud of yourself and devaluing others, being mean, being angry, and cursing God come very much under anger. So, at the time of the two perimeters that I gave you last week, when you are in the most distant state from understanding that trees are trees and mountains are mountains, at that time you are also at the closest place to understanding it. Because that is the moment of transfer, that is the moment of change. And if you carefully go through all of the precepts and your own life, if you analyze you, you will discover how you can gradually work away at the various forms of lust and anger. People don't like it very much when you say that they are suffering from lust. But if you're completely honest with yourself and you look at what you do, you will see that it comes out of desire for something or other. Lust does not necessarily have to be just. I'm a little intimidated. Lust does not necessarily have to be just plain sexual desire. One can lust for all sorts of things. So, remembering this, I just wanted to add that bit to last week's lecture that I hadn't quite finished. I'd like us to look at the work we prepared for this week, page 159 in Selling Water by the River. When one awakens to true wisdom, it means that one is willing to save all living things before one has actually saved oneself. Whether a being is a layman, priest, god, or man, enjoying pleasure or suffering pain, he should awaken this desire as quickly as possible. However humble a person may appear to be, if this desire has been awakened, he is already the teacher of all mankind. A little girl of 7 even may be the teacher of the 4 classes of Buddhists and the mother of true compassion to all living things. One of the greatest teachings of Buddhism is its insistence upon complete equality of the sexes. Now, the first thing you have to watch here is when one has awakened the desire to be a bodhisatta, one is willing to save all living things before one has actually saved oneself, to awaken the desire to save all living things, is to become a bodhisattva. To say, I'm going to drag you into heaven whether you will go or not because I am a bodhisattva, is to become a nuisance. Do not get the two muddled. It is very important not to make that mistake. Too many people think that to become a bodhisattva, you've got to save everybody. If that were so, the cosmic Buddha would have given up centuries ago. What your job as a bodhisattva is to awaken the desire, the longing to save all people, and to try to awaken in everybody else the longing to be saved, not to grab hold of them and try and force them to do that which you want to do. I can remember when I was very young, there was an old story they used to tell in England to try and teach children what not to do if they ever became Christian missionaries. And this story was of a young girl who, a young child, who went along to see a bunch of Africans with a gun and held the gun on them and said, now look, if you don't become Christians and pray, I'll shoot you. That does not turn somebody into a Christian. It may make him very dead and it may make him very angry. The big difference between a true bodhisattva and a do-gooder is that the bodhisattva knows and longs for everyone to become one with the cosmic Buddha. But he does not get out there and say, you've got to do it. And if they don't do it, he does not chase after them. This is a very common mistake. Do not chase after someone. It is enough that you show them the very highest. It is enough that you offer, enough that you try to give. You cannot force a man into heaven. You cannot force anyone to storm heaven. And do not try. To say that I will not enter into enlightenment until every blade of grass goes too is a somewhat of an overstatement. It is not a completely accurate translation of the original. What you are trying to do is, I long for every blade of grass to go with me. I dislike being in enlightenment without every blade of grass. I will show this enlightenment to every blade of grass. I pray they will all come. But do not try to force them to go. All you can do is show the finest thing possible. Thereafter, it is up to them whether they will or not. However much one may drift in the six worlds into the four existences are those of male and female priests and male and female lay persons. However much one may drift in the six worlds and the four existences, even they become a means for realizing the desire for Buddhahood once it has been awakened. However much time we may have wasted up to now, there is still time to awaken this desire. Although our own merit for Buddhahood may be full ripe, it is our bounden duty to use all of this merit for the purpose of enlightening every living thing. At all times there have been those who put their own Buddhahood second to the necessity of working for the good of all other living things, the necessity of working for their good, not grabbing them by the scruff of the neck or the ear and dragging them along. There is a tremendous difference to work for the good of. Also, although our own merit for Buddhahood may be full ripe, it is our duty to give all of that merit. Merit is the only thing that I know of which you can give all of it away and find you've got treble back. what you already gave. But you can't give that merit away thinking, I'll get three times back, because then you are not giving away merit. It has to be a gift that is completely and absolutely given, without any reservation whatsoever. It's very important to remember that. Now, the four wisdoms, charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy, are the means we have of helping others and represent the bodhisattva's aspirations. Charity is the opposite of covetousness. We make offerings although we ourselves get nothing whatsoever. To make an offering of teaching which someone spurns or turns down, to make an offering of one word, one small piece of help, whether a person wants it or whether they do not, it is the making of the offering that matters. That others do not want it is not our problem. We cannot sit there and say, because they don't want it, then I've got to make myself miserable until they do want it. Because that's just a little bit like the little boy sitting there saying, I'll hold my breath until I get what I want. You cannot do that. If they do not want it now, they do not want it now. The bodhisattva's aspiration is to offer. The sign of a bodhisattva is to make the offering, and not to be upset, not to be hurt when he is turned against, turned on, ill-treated, or even thought badly of, which frequently happens. Because frequently the actions that he or she may do will be completely and utterly misunderstood. Because, you see, they are coming from a totally different place from where the actions and thoughts of the average person are coming from. Do you remember I told you about long-sighted seeing? Not just seeing what is going to happen tomorrow or the day after, but taking really careful account of what is going to happen at a long distance from now. The same thing is long-sighted action. It is not just enough to think about the immediate now. One has to think of the future in all of its various directions, its effect on others other than just the person concerned, its effect upon yourself, because you have to be in this too. That is not a selfish thing. We are in training for both self and other. If we leave ourselves out of it, we are trying to pretend to be God. And then, if very soon, we will fail in that particular. You cannot be God. One must look at it from a very long distance, see its possible ramifications, see if it is going to hurt the person concerned. It may not be hurting them now, it may not be hurting them 5 years from now. It may hurt them very seriously 10 or 20 years from now. And you have to see it from the long distance, not the short one. You are coming from a quite different place, because you are coming from that place which, at the end of the third pure precept, as I told you last week, is do good for others. Be beyond the holy and the unholy. Rescue ourselves and others. To be beyond the holy and the unholy. To be beyond the opposites. You cannot get into the right and wrong of anything. You cannot discuss the right and wrong of anything. You have to do it from the right that is beyond the right and wrong. And there, in that place, the action that comes forth is frequently blamed, simply because we are judging with the eyes of the opposites. And this is why so often people who make offerings of merit or charity get blamed, because the people it is offered to are judging with the eyes of the opposites. Parents have a lot of this problem with their children, for obvious reasons. So, it is not your... First, although you awaken the desire, you do not force enlightenment upon anyone. You do not grab them into heaven. Although one of the signs of enlightenment is charity, and you make offerings of everything you have, You do not force them to take it. One of the most beautiful sayings of Dogen was, the truth does not insist upon truth. The bodhisattva does not insist that the whole world shall be bodhisattvas. But just by being one, others want to be them. That is how it is done. There is no attempt to proselytize in Buddhism, and there can never be in consequence. There is no need to be concerned about how small the gift may be, so long as it brings true results, for even if it is only a single phrase or verse of teaching, it may be a seed to bring forth good fruit, both now and hereafter. You don't worry and stay around and say, I wonder if I converted him. Do you think he'll come along on Sunday? Wonder if he is converted. That's not your problem. Your problem is that you didn't even deliberately try to sow a seed. You just did that which was good to do. That it turned into that it went inside the person in the darkness of their subconscious and there germinated and later sprouted is nice. But don't suffer from the idea that you sprouted it. The person with the seed inside him did the sprouting. You, as a person with a self, with an ego, have done nothing. Enlightened action, remember, leaves behind it no speck of dust. If there is dust, if there is, wow, look how I converted him, or I'm glad I did that because it helped him, you're already in duality. It is not your problem. You must be very careful of that. I spoke to you a few weeks back, I think, of the incredible patience of the cosmic Buddha that was spoken of in the Vimalakirti scripture, and how amazed all the bodhisattvas were at how incredibly patient, how still, how full of love the cosmic Buddha really was. And some of them were absolutely horrified at how far away they were from Buddhahood. The reason was that they were attached to good. They were attached to bringing everybody into this wonderful situation. Of course you want them to come, but the attachment to it is the difference between the bodhisattva and the Buddha. The Buddha can wait and just constantly show in every direction. He constantly gives, at every time and in every place, signs. Signs of what he has done, signs of what he will do. All you have to do is look out at the greenery out there, or even look at this table, or the place we are sitting in. All you have to do is look with the eyes of gratitude, and it is the mind of gratitude which is the mind that is enlightened. As you will find when you do the next chapter, the last part of the Shushogi, next week, gratitude, sheer joy at just being alive and what is around you, whether the air is polluted or not, just being full of joy at what there is the main sign of enlightenment. But it is not joy that is irresponsible. It is not the joy of quietism. All I have to do is love everything and take no responsibility. It is the joy of responsible meditation, which is a very different thing. Similarly, the offering of only one coin or blade of grass can cause the arising of good. For the teaching itself is the true treasure, and the true treasure is the very teaching. We must never desire any reward, But we must always share everything we have with others. It is an act of charity to build a ferry or a bridge, and all forms of industry are charity if they benefit others. If one person, shortly after World War II, had not been willing to give me some cash, I would never have gone to university. I would never have been able to win any scholarships. I would never have gone to Japan. And I would never have got where I have now to be able to help, I hope, people with what I am doing. She was an elderly lady who had a lot of money, who was sorry for what was happening to girls after World War II, those especially who had been out working in the forces, whom the government would give nothing to after they came back. She did not realize what she was doing, but hundreds of girls, simply because she gave them £100 every now and then, were able to get decent careers. That is a rightful use of what one possesses. It is also a magnificent act of charity. But she never thought of it as acts of charity. It was simply, well, my stocks and bonds seem to make money. And every time I give 100 away, it's amazing how much more I seem to get. So I don't mind helping you girls. A wonderful way of doing it. A simple act of charity. She was not putting a lot of heavy religious trip on us. She was simply saying, all right, now all I'm asking is, if you find somebody who's stuck when you're rich, don't forget. And most of us have done just that. What is an act of charity? There was nothing there. There were absolutely no strings. I strongly suspect she, who we must be dead by now because she must be well over 100, is doing rather well with the Buddhas and patriarchs. For that is how an act of charity is done. It is not holding on to something. She was not a rich woman, but she became a much richer one for what she was doing. And also a lot of other people became a lot richer because they were able to have decent lives. And she got something else. She got a lot of blessings on her name. Understand what acts of charity are. They do not leave behind great big plaques on buildings which say the Rockefeller Center and this sort of thing. They are things that are done gently and quietly, without a lot of noise, and definitely without a lot of trumpet blowing. To behold all beings with the eye of compassion and to speak kindly to them is the meaning of tenderness. If one would understand tenderness, one must speak to others whilst thinking that one loves all living things as if they were one's own children. By praising those who exhibit virtue and feeling sorry for those who do not, our enemies become our friends, and they who are our friends have their friendship strengthened. This is all through the power of tenderness. Whenever one speaks kindly to another, his face brightens and his heart is warmed. If a kind word be spoken in his absence, the impression will be a deep one. Tenderness can have a revolutionary impact upon the mind of man. Now, tenderness here spoken of is somewhat different from what it is normally thought of. I told you once that no matter who comes to Shasta, he or she must be seen as the Buddha incarnate, no matter what state they may be in. One has to see the Buddha nature in all living things. One must not consider, well, I can see the Buddha in him, but I can't see it in her over there, so this is the one I'll follow and not that one. The instant you set up what is a Buddha and what is not, what is a person worth living with and who is not, The instant you set this up, you start placing a value on the spirit. You place a value on the cosmic Buddha, you set up your totem pole, and you place yourself in the opposites to such an extent that when anything goes wrong, you can be extraordinarily badly hurt. If, on the other hand, you think of all equally, sometimes they get caught in the opposites, sometimes they don't. If you love them deeply, feel glad, as he says, about those who exhibit virtue, and do not scold and get angry with, but be sorry for those who do not. And I'm not talking about here pitying people. There's a great deal of difference between being sorry for someone and pitying them. If you can live that way, you can get to a state of tenderness when love will ripen almost like an exquisite fruit. But it is very important to understand that being sorry is not the same as pitying someone. Never make the mistake of using pity. And also, do not make the mistake of getting angry. The old Buddhist method of dealing with trainees who were troublemakers in the order, and there were a few, comes into this very much. The rule says, if a person is breaking the rules, you do not speak about him in public, you do not give him a bad reputation. First of all, you meditate on it in order to give him as much merit as possible. Maybe he needs some merit. If that doesn't work, you very quietly and gently talk to him, the way it used to be done in the East, which you'd be invited to tea. And usually after dark. I never could completely understand why they always did it after dark, but maybe they felt they were more relaxed then. And they would point out to you very, very gently what it was that was contrary to the teachings, contrary to the rules, and why. They didn't say, look, that's the rule and you're going to keep it. It would be, now the rule is this way because, and they would tell you what the first person, what the story was of the person who had first caused the rule to come into existence, which is why the Pratimoksha, which is the book of rules, doesn't give you any actual rule. It gives you all the case histories. There are some that are really faintly funny. You get one which one rule which says, never sit in a room with a member of the opposite sex with the door locked if an unintelligent person is in the room next door. You don't have to think too hard to work out what happens. They're very sensible rules. In other words, don't place yourself in such a situation that you're going to be put yourself both in difficulties with the authorities and with the congregation. Very simple things, and they will explain it to you very sensibly, and you've got to be awfully thick in the skull and very determined not to keep the rules, to continue to break them. However, if one does, then they have three or four people who come and have tea with you, and if that doesn't work, then they suggest that maybe you might like to go away for a bit and think it over. But spreading a bad reputation or talking about people behind their backs, this is regarded as one of the worst and gravest crimes that can happen in a temple, because it breaks up the harmony and the joy and the peace quicker than anything else. And they get very mad at people who talk about others, because that is regarded as being a complete layman. It's a terrible thing, isn't it, being a complete layman? There are some differences between monk and layman. I always felt that they were a little wrong to say that it was being a complete layman, because not all laymen are like that. But I know what they're trying to say, and it's this difficulty of words. What are we going to use for words in order to explain something? Anyway, that is the meaning of tenderness. however bad someone may be in the eyes of the world, in the sense of good and bad, one has to act from beyond that, in the place which is beyond the good that is beyond good, and see that no matter what this person is doing, the Buddha inside him is perfect and pure. And that is what you are interested in, and that is what you love, and what you want to be with, and what you want to come out. All this other stuff is just froth on the surface. Now, don't get worried by this froth. That doesn't count. Because the true reality is the Buddha that lies within him, not what he's up to outside. Which, as I said last week, is why you don't have problems with homosexuals or heterosexuals or anything else. What matters is the Buddha nature. We are in this business for Buddha nature. We are in this business to become as close to the Buddha as possible. And the Buddha doesn't worry about external things. And neither should we, if that is what we are aiming to be like. If one creates wise ways of helping beings, whether they be in high places or lowly stations, one exhibits benevolence. No reward was sought by those who rescued the helpless tortoise and the sick sparrow, these acts being utterly benevolent. The stupid believe that they will lose something if they give help to others, but this is completely untrue, for benevolence helps everyone, including oneself, being a law of the universe. Now here again, the point is made that benevolence is something that we do without getting reward for it. In other words, the bodhisattva ideal can be very dangerous. You see, you can be so tender with somebody that he doesn't do a thing at all. Now, you can't just let him go on and on and on doing wrong. Finally, you do have to say no, because that will be irresponsible. So the desire to make it, to want to be with him, and the desire to love the Buddha within him does not allow you to allow him to continue to make the same mistakes. Supposing you had a monk who was constantly getting drunk, you would have to say no to such behavior. Now, the perfect state of the bodhisattva is, oh no, we must go on and on forever. But that is not being correct. If one wishes to go beyond the bodhisattva to Buddhahood, it is also true here with benevolence. One cannot expect any reward. No matter how benevolent our acts may be, we do not do them to get rewards. The reward of their becoming Buddha, the reward of their becoming holier. We just do the benevolent acts for the sake of doing benevolent acts. And this is the meaning of what is called later doing training for training's sake. We do that which has to be done because it's the only way to live. But we don't do it to drag somebody into heaven or to drag them into religion. We do it because that is what is right and natural for us to do as individuals. If one can identify oneself with that which is not oneself, one can understand the true meaning of sympathy. Take, for example, the fact that the Buddha appeared in the human world in the form of a human being. Sympathy does not distinguish between oneself and others. There are times when the self is infinite and times when this is true of others. Sympathy is as the sea, that it never refuses water from whatsoever source it may come. All waters may gather and form only one sea. You do not fully understand that until you have had at least one or two past lives come up. And you feel, well, this is not me. I have got to bless this and let it go. You have to do more than bless it. You have to embrace it. For although it is not you, there is nothing in you that is not part of you. Therefore, you have to embrace this as something that has made an aspect of your character. And whilst not copying its mistakes, you cannot separate yourself from it. This was what I was trying to get over when I was quoting in my in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, the part about the tiger. Have you read that yet, any of you? Did I give that to people to read? I'd like you to work on that, if you would. I should put that up on the board for next time. Page 61 to 74. If you would truly understand what sympathy means, you need to study the story of the tiger life in detail. It is a willingness to be completely and absolutely possessed by that which is not oneself, whilst knowing that the true you can never be possessed by anything. It is a willingness to give absolutely. If one can identify oneself with that which is not oneself, it's more than identify. It's, what's a good word? What's a word that goes further than identify?
Unify.
At one-ment, yes. Anything, but it's a complete mixture. It's body, soul, mind, brain, everything getting mixed in together, and not worrying that they are mixed up.
Empathizes.
That was the one I was trying to think of and couldn't remember it. Thank you. Yes, to empathize absolutely, without fear, because too many people are afraid to empathize. They're afraid they'll lose themselves, but that is only because they don't know what the true self is. You can only lose yourself if you don't know what, if you are not in possession of the self. When you're in possession of the self, then you've got nothing to lose. You really have to know who you are, and that no one and no thing can take it away from you. O you seekers of enlightenment, meditate deeply upon these teachings and do not make light of them. Give respect and reverence to their merit, which brings blessing to all living things. Help all beings cross over to the other shore. I've often thought that one of the reasons why people do not seem body, people who've had the Bodhisattva Kensho, the third Kensho, do not seem to have as much success as they otherwise would, is because although they have dealt with lust completely and with irritation completely, too much success could, it's just possible that pride could enter in. Just possible. The old story that the higher one goes, the further one has to fall, if one does fall, applies here. I know of at least one person who had an extraordinarily good Kensho, probably a second, but not a third, who became so proud of what he'd managed that now the second state of that man is much worse than when he first came to me. He's no longer with us. One has to be very careful of spiritual pride entering into it. Very careful indeed. And perhaps if one had too much success, that would be a big danger. I have often thought that perhaps that is the reason, but I have no proof of that. Right, now I'd like you to go from there. I asked you to look at the Sankon Zazen Setsu, which was page 269. It was one of the things I asked you to work on last week. Interestingly enough, this is actually backwards. But since I didn't put it together, Dogen did, I'm not going to say anything about it. In the sense that the paragraphs, well, he starts with the highest and works down. I would have started with the lowest and worked up. But I suppose it doesn't terribly much matter. Page 268. The person who does Zazen of the highest type has no interest in such matters as how Buddhas appear in this present world, nor does he consider truths which are untransmittable by even the Buddhas and patriarchs. He does not doctrinalize about all things being expressions of the self, for he is beyond enlightenment and delusion. Since he never considers anything from a dualistic angle, nothing whatsoever enslaves him, even when differences show themselves. He just eats when he is hungry and sleeps when he is tired. That is the sign of someone who has had a fourth cantrell, the fourth and final one. Now, I dislike, as I have said on other occasions, chopping things in bits and saying this is a first, this is a second, this is a third, and this is a fourth. But there are very definite signs of what happens at each one. And just as the as I told you in the first lecture, you have the stream entrant and the once returner and the non-returner. Then you have this one, the enlightened one. It's frequently very difficult to know where the third ends and the fourth begins. Because, as I said, it's like going down a screw and the thing gets further and further down and you're constantly going in that direction. Constantly, constantly going. And in one sense, to say there are only four is wrong, because there's much more than that. This is only the tip of the iceberg. Let me put it this way. There's only four that I've ever heard anybody write about, which might be a little more accurate. But there is definitely much more than that. Now, the signs show at each stage. That is the sign, what I've just read there, of what they say of the fourth one in the Theravada school, which of course very much likes to analyze it all out. Delight in subtler forms, the condition of being absorbed in ecstasy and bliss, born of meditation, in the level of absorption. Delight in the formless meditation, a somewhat similar absorption, but in a higher level. In other words, the person has got over those. He no longer just loves to meditate. He no longer longs for the meditation hours because it's so joyful. He just eats when he's hungry and sleeps when he's tired. He has got even beyond that. Sometime, if I know you a lot better, I'll talk to you about that a bit more. That's aimed at the Priory congregation. Pride or ego, comparing oneself with others. Now, that was the one I warned you about, because that one goes on hitting all the way up through all of the cantrells. And it's the very last thing to go. You can get rid of lust, you can get rid of irritation, you can get rid of the joy of meditation. The very last one is pride of achievement. Oh, wow, look how I was able to help so-and-so yesterday. And immediately you've been caught by it. So that is the last of the great fetters to go. Distracting thoughts, that's not very often. The only time you have distracting thoughts in the higher, something that one has had to deal with on the higher levels, is if one has got a bunch of monks who are constantly restless. And you only get a bunch of monks that are constantly restless if you haven't taught them properly. So I don't know of any Zen master that I know personally who has still got that one to deal with. But I don't know most of the ones in America personally. Ignorance, which is the last one. Ignorance in the sense of wondering about what other people's, what other Zen masters' actions mean. Ignorance in the sense of not trusting completely in them. But if we go to the signs of the third Kensho, which is the second part of the Sankon Zazen Setsu. The person who does Zazen of the less high type gives up everything and cuts all ties. Since throughout the entire day he is never idle, every moment of his life, every breath is a meditation. The considerations of life and death, or going and staying, are not to be seen upon his face. The discriminatory mind can never perceive the highest truth of the eternal, nor can it comprehend the Buddha mind. Since there is no dualism in his thought, he is enlightened. From the far past to the present day, wisdom is always shining clearly and brightly. The whole universe in all the 10 directions is permeated suddenly by the illumination from his head. All phenomena are seen separately within his body. Now, if you go through the lotus blossom, as we will be doing after, that reminds me, you should be doing, I didn't put that up, would you add this to the board, please? 61 to 111. That explains very clearly what they are talking about here. And it also explains what they're talking about in the five sections of the Hui Ming Ching. Now, the personality changes, as I said earlier, that happen in this particular stage, which is that of the non-returner, is the complete removal of lustful desire and the complete removal of irritation. These two here. The last one, which I won't bother to read all the way through, shows what is required to get a first Kensho or to attain the position of stream entrant. And as I pointed out to you some weeks back, this is the eradication, the personality change here is the certainty of faith, the realization that things are going to change and that you're not going to be eternally as you are now, and the lack of clinging to things as they are. So there you have your three. The second one is very interesting, the second Kensho, and I've talked about it. I've called it the ongoing Fugen Kensho in Zen's Eternal Life, because it's literally a constantly going down the threads of the screw. What's the man's name? Daisetsu Suzuki had a very interesting name for what happened during second, this is what he called the second Kensho, what they called it in Japan, and that is, a million times we have, only once or twice do we have the great understanding. 3 times if we are lucky, 4 times if we are extraordinarily lucky. But a million times the little moments that make one dance. And it's the little moments that make one dance that make up the second canto. The little moments which, when one is in extreme darkness, that just make the darkness worth going through. When one is in extreme aridity, the little moments where one gets sort of, so to speak, watered in the desert, and you've got the strength to go on and do it. The little moments that make one dance. It was one of the most beautiful things I ever heard him say. A million times, once or twice I have had the great understanding, but a million times the little moments that make one dance. And that is the perfect description of the ongoing Fugeng Kendro. The constant seeing of little signs of love that keep the faith going. I am looking at the beginning of the scriptures now, page 273. I'm trying to tie up a lot of loose ends in this lecture. If you look at page 273, the scripture of Kanzi Om Bosatsu. This scripture is read every morning after one has done one's meditation. It's read for a number of reasons. It is read to prepare you, faith-wise, for everything that may happen during the day. How does the cosmic Buddha show his compassion? In other words, how does the cosmic Buddha appear as Bodhisattva? How does he help? In what ways does he help? This could actually be the scripture of the cosmic Buddha, but if they made it that, it would be too absolute. So it is an aspect of the cosmic Buddha, the Kanzion aspect, the compassion aspect. How does the compassion aspect of the cosmic Buddha show? And the answer is, if you have faith at all times and in all places, then it will show at all times and in all places. And they try to go through, you should know that Mujindi Bodhisattva, by the way, is the equivalent of Saint Everyman. It's you and I and Bill Jones asking questions of the Buddha. What does the Buddha do? How does Kanzion appear? Mujindi is made, I think the popular term is the fall guy frequently and all. He asks all the stupid questions, the dumb questions. He is a very valuable person, Mujindi Bodhisattva. Without him we would not be able to identify frequently with the people in the scriptures. So you should understand his purpose. And he's saying, look, Shakyamuni Buddha, world-honored one, what's the purpose of Kanzion? Who is he? What does he do? Well, he is the perfect son of the Buddha. In other words, everyone who shows compassion, genuine compassion, is a true son of the Buddha. And in so doing, we are able to see the cosmic Buddha through him. This is how compassion appears. This is how we see compassion. Now, if we have true faith, we can turn that stream of compassion within, and we can have compassion upon ourselves and upon other people. And in so doing, it is we who will be the true son or daughter of the Buddha, which is the result of our true faith. And then, the world-honored one, that is Shakyamuni Buddha, proceeds to go through all the different ways in which one can be heard, in which one can be hurt, and in which one can, if one has faith, one can never be really hurt. If wishing harm, an enemy should try to push another in a fiery pit. If the victim thinks truly on Kanzion. In other words, if he takes refuge truly in the compassion of Kanzion, nothing's going to hurt him. If there's an executioner with a sword who is about to kill him, if he truly takes refuge in the cosmic Buddha, the compassion of the cosmic Buddha will stop any real damage. That does not mean to say that his head is not going to be lopped off. It is. What it does mean is that his true spirit will not be damaged. He will go straight to the cosmic Buddha. Though incorrect, he won't die in fear. In other words, he will be beyond fear. Now, that brings me to the rightful use of the Kyosak, which I have never discussed with anybody to my knowledge. I have written all sorts of things around it and about it because we had to wait until people had got over a certain amount of scaredy-cat feelings as to what its purpose was, not least of which were some people who were using it for completely wrong reasons. The English translation of why it is used in Japan frequently leaves much to be desired. The wording is usually to give us courage, to courage us, or to encourage us. Now, that is not true. The purpose of the use of the Kyosak is to give us courage to leap beyond all fear, the courage to leap beyond the opposites. Now, I have been talking to you about the leap up in this book. By the way, I'm going over a bit today. We won't have nearly as much time for questions and answers. I hope you don't mind. But I've got to tie all these ends off before I get to the next stage.
Excuse me, do people know what Kyosaki is?
Oh. Sorry. It's a long... Thank you for telling me. It's a long stick with which trainees in the meditation hall are beaten. They should only receive it if they ask for it. In the old days, that's all it was ever used for. Later on, it was used for the purpose of getting people's courage up to leap beyond all fear. You remember? He flies above the sun and the clouds to see the real man in the imperial court. People are very, very scared. They frequently feel incredible fear during meditation. That is because the spirit wishes to fly. It wishes to move. And they are terrified of it. And the old way of making it move was to literally beat them. Now, we don't do anything of that nowadays, because we have very sincere meditators, and I can explain to them that absolutely there's nothing to be afraid of. And because I do it every day of the week, they aren't scared of it. You know, there's nothing like copying what somebody else is doing to take away the scaredy-cat feelings of doing it. It really works. And therefore, it is not necessary for this purpose. You'll see why I'm doing this later. The Litany of the Great Compassionate One, which is on page numbers 592, speaks of what happens in meditation. Adoration to Kanzion, who is the Great Compassionate One. Adoration to the Triple Treasure. First we take refuge in the Buddha, and then we take refuge in the compassion aspect of ourselves, because we have hit the center point here and are now closer than we have ever been to really getting into ourselves. We are turning the stream of compassion within. Om to the one who leaps beyond all fear. Having adored him, may I enter into the heart of the noble adored Kanzion. That's the first thing. Homage to the one who leaps beyond all fear. Suddenly, it jumps out. Remember, the hidden dragon is now transformed into a flying dragon. It appears. The spirit passes freely and cannot be deprived. One sunrise, it jumps out beyond the radiance of the jewel, and producing the Son of the Lord, arrives straightway at the heavenly court. Because people were so incredibly afraid of the second and third stages of meditation, The Cure-Sac was used to get them beyond fear. You had two choices. You could put up with the pain, which was terrifying, or you could go on with your meditation. It is not a nice thing to do, but it works. I thought I would tell you that because so many people misunderstand the use of the Cure-Sac in modern days. But that is the purpose of it. Hail to the one who leaps beyond all fear. And you really do have to leap beyond all fear to fly above and to have the dragon become the true dragon. What have we got for questions, friends?
Yes. I've been wondering, with children, in regard to the same thing about not forcing, I had a discussion with my children just the other night, and it was to the effect that what you take into your mind is of great importance. The Dawn of the Dead and the Invasion of the Body Snatchers and
They do have some tripe on TV, don't they?
Well, this is movies, and it's incredibly gross. It's incredibly negative and incredibly bloody, and anyway, my son then was, I don't know, I can't talk to him. Anyway, it was
how old
was he? 19 and 18. And I was overwhelmed with this deluge of you have not seen it, you don't, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I still feel that there is some virtue in pointing out that what you take in, what the kind of environment you have around you influences the way you look on life.
I'm not sure, however. yes, I agree with you on that. But I'm not sure that sort of trying to discourage somebody from seeing such things, and believe me, I find them revolting, I'm not sure that that's exactly the right way to go about it, simply because somebody tried to do that with me, and the result was that I spent years in my youth deliberately seeking such things out until one day somebody sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You're an ass. Why are you doing this to you?" And I sat back and said, "You're darn right. It's an awful waste of time," and I stopped.
But you can't even point it out.
Well, maybe you should just let him gross himself out, which is what I did. I hate to put it that way, but that may be the answer.
A lot of kids respond by telling you to go see more of it. The more
it's just possible.
It doesn't help to tell somebody in that situation.
Yeah, but in other words, that is also a case of trying to force.
Yeah. They know there's something inside them that already.
You see, I knew that it was junk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was aware that it's junk, but they're aware it's junk. Mm-hmm. 18 and 19, you bet they know.
Yeah, and so it's forcing.
It's just, I am a slight oddball in some ways. I am of the opinion that our whole educational system is wrong. If I had my way, we would not have a compulsory educational system. Everybody would be entitled to, shall we say, 10 or 20 years education, which they could take at any time in their life, which would effectively stop us having schools stuffed with people who didn't want to be there. And you'd always, everyone would be entitled to this, so nobody would be deprived of an education, but they would take it when they wanted it. That's what I'd like to see happen. I think we get a lot better response and a lot fewer square pegs in round holes. It's just my personal opinion. Anyway, go ahead.
Sort of on the same point, my wife and I were talking over this resurgence of horror movies that seems to be occurring right now. Maybe it's always been there in this.
Well, I have been absolutely exulting in being able to get channels 9, 54, and 60, so I really don't know what's on the others.
Right. These haven't quite made it to the TV yet. They're just in
oh.
the theater.
Oh.
And you'll see billboards for them now. They're getting increasingly graphic. But yeah. Dracula's coming back very strong.
Mm-hmm.
She's
suggested.
Yeah, but
yeah.
These are not getting harmless. Yeah. They're getting worse.
She suggested that it's a symptom of social tension, that people are dimly aware that there are massive problems facing our culture that we're really not dealing with in a very effective way. And even the experts are kind of pulling the wool over our eyes.
Well, there is another side to it, and that is they are a form of pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Because real pornography is anything that causes anxiety. And we have got so far away from our spiritual centers that what we are needing is more and more to titillate us, to get us interested and stop us being bored. And so we have to make it more and more gross in order to be less bored. And all it is eventually going to do is gross us out to such an extent that maybe we will turn and turn inwards and start meditating. Interestingly enough, I never really completely meditated properly until I was grossed out on a German movie. Which is a side of me nobody knows about. It was horror movies that got me going on meditation. So it can have a good effect. But I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen with everybody who watches it. I said, I don't want to do this anymore. All I'm doing is hurting me. I just slammed the thing off and I haven't watched one since. Not to say watch it, and occasionally I babysat people who couldn't really meditate properly and wanted to watch a horror movie, and they said, wasn't it good when it was over? And I've said yes, and a couple of them come up to me afterwards and said, but you were asleep. You were dead right. But that's not the end of it. No, it was an actual German horror movie that did that. Really ghastly.
I had the same reaction to MASH when I saw it.
Well, MASH?
Everybody was laughing and I suddenly got a pretty movie.
The actual movie?
Yeah.
Oh, the movie is nasty.
I got really upset. And when I came out of the theater, I was in such a state that I could feel the energy of the light bulbs in the marquee.
Yeah. I got the same effect off of, oddly enough, the snideness in the Mikado. How mean everyone was being to everybody. You see, in the end, if it really hits you as to what it is, pornography, it'll start you going, and you begin to see what people are really doing to each other, and calling it entertainment. So, if they do make the move, and it's not a bad idea to let them gross themselves. I'm not sure.
Damage?
Don't take my word for it.
Isn't a lot of damage done to your soul?
Well, remember that it says that it is never too late to awaken the seed of Buddhahood. No matter how late, it is never too late to awaken the Bodhisattva seed. It didn't do any damage to me.
Go ahead. I wanted to ask about something regarding the circulation of the breath, as
yes.
mentioned in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. Because I came across this sentence in The Human Change, which says the breath that flows in and out through the nose is not the true breath. The flowing in and out of the true breath takes place in connection with it.
Yes, and you don't find that out so long as you think about, well, is this the true breath or is it not the true breath? Because then you're like Father Christmas's beard, is it in or out the bed when I'm asleep? What you do is you just breathe. And one day the thing will change in a very subtle, exquisite way. And you will then know what the true breath is, but it's useless for me to try and sit here and explain it. You just breathe normally, and one day something happens in the chest, and the thing changes. And you begin to know what the true breath is. And it's what I told you about, it comes leaping on the new air. It's just like life leaping. It's when you realize that the breath of life really is the breath of life, and it's not the old breath, but it's the old breath, all right?
You got my point.
I just wondered why you hadn't mentioned that specifically in the appendix.
Well, I haven't mentioned it for exactly the reason you got when I just tried to explain it.
Yeah. Yes.
Can you say more about, you were just talking about the spirit wanting to fly out during meditation and it causing fear, and sort of when that happens, at what stage?
It happens at the stage, once one has turned the stream of compassion completely within, once one has realized that the precepts, that one keeps the precepts, because if one doesn't, one hurts oneself. And then one decides that out of compassion for oneself, one will keep the precepts. And later, out of compassion for the whole universe, one will keep the precepts. But at the moment you decide to keep them out of compassion, and not out of compulsion from outside, i.e. from compassion within rather than from a father figure or something that is compulsion from outside, then the spirit is free to fly. And it's not free to fly until you reach that compassion stage.
Can you say more about that? I mean, what you described in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom is for the third Kensha, so I didn't think it's not the same thing.
No, it's not completely the same thing. The water rises and flies when one meditates. You see, it's this business of cutting it up in bits.
It's not like a one-time thing. It's flowing and moving and changing constantly. You can't like pin it down.
It's always changing and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And one day it seems to solidify, and that's the day when it flies. But it is always moving.
And this causes great fear.
When it first starts to move, it causes terror. Because it's like a rushing that comes up the spine and over the front. You just let it go. Just sit back and enjoy it.
The question that is asked, or that you write about, when we ask, what is the purpose of my life?
Mm-hmm.
If the purpose of our lives is to train as hard as we can, as well as we can, it's hard for me to understand what difference it makes what it is we do.
Well, first of all, you have to know why the question is asked. You see, that which called this psychophysical being into existence was the karma. Had to have a body in order to get itself dealt with. Now, once you have cleaned up all that karma, there comes a moment when, what is the point of going on? All right, that which caused this to come into existence is now dealt with. So, you wish to continue? What's the point of it? Why? What is your purpose for staying and going on? Because the purpose for going on has now ceased. The purpose for being here has now ceased. So it is now the purpose for continuing.
Well, the question underneath the question has to do with, for instance, to be a monk or to be a layman.
Yes.
I mean, it feels like
it's the outward form. I don't really think
form.
That you've got that as a problem. I think the problem is that once you have got to the state that question is asked, because you have cleaned up the karma, the only real question that can be asked is the only real answer to the question that is asked, what is your purpose for living, is to become one with the cosmic Buddha. Now, the external trappings of that are neither here nor there. And Vimalakirti had certainly proved but you can do it as a layman. he's somewhat better than somebody Saturday I know. So, yeah. But you should know that that question does not get asked until all of the karma is cleaned up. Because you could actually die at that moment. This is what Dogen talks about when he, in the Fukanza Zenge, when he says the ability to die while sitting and standing, which transcends both peasant and sage, is achieved through the power of Zazen. In other words, if you cleaned up all your karma and you get up in a hurry, rather than taking it easy, you can walk right away from the body. And I have seen somebody do it. So the deeper you get into meditation, the more important it is to sway carefully and gently before you get up, because if you've cleaned everything up.
Yes?
I was wondering how the flowing of the water relates to the piercing of the seven major chakras in, like, in Kundalini yoga.
It's very close. It's very, very close. The danger of doing it from a Kundalini point of view is that you can misunderstand. You can get stopped at a certain stage instead of continuing. You can say, okay, this is all there is to it, when in fact you have to go on much, much further. I don't mind whether you call it Kundalini or what. It's only really first stage meditation. You have to go on to the second and third and the fourth and the fifth. You might, don't just get stuck with the one. But there's nothing wrong with it, with that. And that flowing of water is very much the same thing. In fact, I'd say it is the same thing. Yeah?
It seems that throughout the picture of the screw, it is that constant vigilance, the on guard, but...
You can never let the screwdriver slip.
But without fear. I mean, that, it's such an incredibly delicate thing to be vigilant without tension, without, well, not tension, but this fear. I mean, of course, the equation is, vigilance is...
That's
very
right.
Hard to have relaxed attention.
Yeah. Yes, it's. That's why it's such hard work. And the higher you go, the harder work it is.
More vigilance.
Yes. You dare. You remember I said I dare not even contemplate the possibility of the possibility of even thinking of the possibility of maybe there could be a doubt. The higher, the rougher it gets, because the further down you can crash. Anyway, we'd better turn around and do some meditating. Yes?
So, would be good entertainment then would be something more along the lines of not selling wine of delusion then?
If you can find it. It might not be a bad idea to watch and recognize when the wine of delusion is being sold. Some of the best entertainment, odd as it may seem, because it shows you what not to do, is the soap operas of an afternoon. There's one specific one that I watch periodically called The Guiding Light, in which nobody ever does anything because they're always convinced that they're going to hurt somebody. And they end up doing massive catastrophes with all their friends and neighbors. And it's a perfect show for teaching you act. And in the end, you know, I used to put it on occasionally for monks to watch it. Why doesn't he do something? Good! They're getting the point of this thing. It's to act, it's to move, it's not to piddle about there. Yes, some of them can be very valuable. The interesting thing about the soap operas is that each one seems to be aimed at people with specific, that do the same sort of thing. I don't know whether they're supposed to be aimed, this particular one is supposed to be aimed at everybody who can't move so that they can realize everybody's like that, or whether it's to prove to them that they shouldn't be like that. But each soap opera has a different slant. Very different slant, slightly different slant.
The interesting thing about this soap opera is the music matches it. It's sort of, the music sort of, looks like
it's
everybody's,
masterly.
Everyone's moving through jelly. And you feel like their will has just turned to so much
mush.
Yeah.
Over.
We've named it the Guiding Blight. But such things can be used really positively for teaching. You can use the Munsters, which is interestingly enough, along the same lines. Because you've got the one person, the daughter, who's extremely beautiful and completely seems to be normal, and the rest of the family is all up the spout and weird. And a lot of us can, a lot of people can identify with that, recognizing themselves, of course, as the one and only that's worth knowing. And by watching the program, you can realize that however weird the other people are in it, they are very beautiful people. They may look odd, or they may have something odd about them, but they are really good people. You can make a tremendous amount of use of things of that sort. But they're just plain pornographic, you can do nothing with. You can ever get bored and want to smash the set. Yes, it is good stuff. Although once you realize that something is bad, as I did, and I said it drove me into meditation, I could not watch any of those horrors ever again. Oddly enough, the nearest I could get to one was Star Wars, which somebody wanted me to go and see. It shows you exactly how far down the horror line I'm willing to go. Once you, any of them really hits you as to what's going on, it is as if you hit the mind of the writer. And if the mind of the writer was really impure at the time of doing it, you can never watch it again. I could never watch the Mikado again. Simply because I heard the snide meanness that was going on. And I really heard it. I've not been able to watch it again.
One thing that a friend of ours told us that struck me very meaningful about this is what he's an Aikido teacher who studied in Japan, and one thing that struck him as really odd was his own Aikido teacher watching a American Western film and saying, "Oh my God, it's so violent, it's terrible," and then watching a samurai film with arms and limbs and things being sliced all directions and saying how marvelous it was, and he couldn't understand it. But then he realized that the difference between the two is that in the Western, it is violence for the sake of violence. In other words, the hero gets absolutely furious and is tearing people up, and there's this uncontrolled rage going on. And in the samurai film, they act from dead center, and the only emotion is that which is necessary. And there's a difference, if you think of it, there is a calmness. Acting from stillness. And there's the difference. Now, there is a violence in the samurai film of the other kind, and there has to be something for the samurai to act against, obviously.
The first time I ever really completely understood that was in the Far East, when I had been nursing one of the monks who was very ill. They were waiting for a night nurse to come, and I was looking after him and doing the temperature and all that stuff. And it was mid-July, and July in Japan can be a cross between a hot tub and a samovar, and you're sitting inside. And I decided that I was going to get myself a bath, and I didn't know that it was, I'd been there so short a time, I didn't know that in that particular house there was a specific pecking order for taking baths. And one of the officials came up to me and was blowing me up for taking a bath before the director. And suddenly I realized that he was not angry at all. He was making noise. Well, there was a big grin inside saying, I'm glad you got a bath. And then I realized that you could do things from that place without any self getting in the way. Very interesting thing to discover. And that's exactly what you were talking about.
Mind you, in the Japanese films, they've made this a kind of a set theme and then go ahead to extort all kinds of slicings and cuttings. So it's,
yes, you do have to be careful. We're not saying that watch all the samurai movies because their violence is better than our violence. That's not what we're saying. Violence is violence. We are saying hear where the writer is coming from, which is very different. Anything else, Rand? Yes, go ahead.
I was thinking about films, and I think they saw it in the Abbey, and we saw it prior to the German documentary. And that raises the thing of looking at it, at reflections of possibilities within ourselves, of being able, you could see I, Claudius, and still having the mind that could say, never me, you know, not excluding that. Saying, seeing what could I do?
Well, I was saying to the monks the other day, I saw as a youngster some of the original posters that the Nazis put out to get people to join the army and the like. And if I had been a young man of 17 who had seen that poster and I had been German, I'd have joined. It would have been the perfect image of me as a young man, you know. Handsome, fair-haired, blue-eyed, strong, courageous. All the romantic things that a teenager likes to think he is. It would have been perfect. I wouldn't have worried too much about the theories that went on. I can see exactly how those young people went in. And it's scary when you realize that, because you realize the situation that young people are in and how easily they can be brainwashed into doing these things. There was also a very fascinating program on that I'm hoping comes on again. I tried to get all the monks in the priory to watch it. This was a few nights back, but unfortunately they were all very busy and I only got one, which was on the present state of things in Germany. I'm sure you've heard that they are trying to, they have agreed to extend the time for hunting for Nazi war criminals. But this program pointed out why they had not done anything with most of them. They had caught the big ones, but they hadn't bothered with the rest. And the reason was very simple. Since everybody over the age of 10 had been in the Nazi party and involved in it, they would have had to have killed off everybody over the age of 10 and under the age of 70 when World War II ended. They got a tremendous number of them in jail and they suddenly realized there was nobody to run the country. There was going to be absolutely no one to run anything, and if they killed off all that lot, then they would be worse or at least equal with the Nazis themselves. So there they are faced with, do we let them get away with murder? The program was, do we let them get away with murder?
A blind eye to murder,
that's right. Do we turn a blind eye to murder? Think about it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did if you really have enough...
It was the most important and the most terrifying program I've seen in the last 10 years, because it really brings up something an incredibly important.
And yet, you know, there's a 7-hour film, new film of Hitler. It's called Our Hitler. It's 7 hours long, and just I don't know if you've seen it, but apparently it just does everything with him.
Well, you see, and this is exactly the point they were making in this documentary. If we let them get away with it, the young are saying, well, then they didn't do all that badly anyway, so maybe Hitler was good.
Yeah.
there's a very large resurgence of the Nazi Party.
Yeah.
That's the thought.
But do you see that? You see the problem? Either we do the same thing, or we allow that resurgence to possibly take place. If it comes on again, I strongly recommend you see it. It's called Blind Eye to Murder. It really brings the problem up. It sits you on the point of the sword of justice with regard to the corn, and whichever way you turn, you're not merely going to get pricked, you're going to get sliced.